I was witnessing another well-practiced piece of theatre. I asked her about meeting Idi Amin, Saddam Hussein, Mao Zedong, Yasser Arafat and Kim Il-sung. Ah, Kim Il-sung, she said softly. A much misunderstood man. He had the warmest handshake and such piercing eyes. It was as if he could see straight through you. And Chairman Mao. She appeared for a moment to be overcome with emotion. A light tremor went through her frame. He was a great man, a great Asian man. And do you know what he said to me? He said that he'd seen China Nights during the war, and he thanked me for it. I felt as though a great weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I didn't quite know what to say. A better interviewer might have pushed her more. After a moment's silence, she said, I know I was once on the wrong side of things. That is why I want us all to be friends. I will be a bridge between peoples. That is my goal, my life's work. China Nights continued to haunt me through the years. I met Yamaguchi a few times afterward, but she remained an enigma. All I ever got was a repeat performance. Her story had become a modern myth in Japan, celebrated in several movies, more than one ghosted autobiography, a play, a musical, and even a number of manga. She was never going to depart from the myth. I ended up writing a novel about her many years later, which is less a story about her actual life, the truth of which remains elusive, than a fictional account of her invented one. In the end, I had to leave my beloved apartment in Meijido. The owners, a businessman with a crooked row of shiny gold teeth and his dreadful beady-eyed wife, wanted to tear the building down and build a modern apartment block or perhaps a car park. I didn't want to move, and neither did the anxious couple living downstairs. It is difficult to kick sitting tenants out in Japan as long as they pay their rent in escrow at the local ward office. At first, the wife would drop by in an attempt to persuade us to move. I told her that I couldn't afford to right now. Her eyes narrowed and a shrewd little smile cracked her powdery face. We all know what gaijin are like. We know you gaijin are good at making money. Always alert to an anti-Semitic slur, I thought of all the books I'd seen at various stores in Tokyo explaining how Jews rarely ran the world. But I don't think that is what she meant. Gaijin probably just meant gaijin, greedy, materialistic, crude. Persuasion soon changed to pressure. The anxious young mother downstairs was in tears one day after the landlady had threatened her and warned that the house would collapse in an earthquake and her child would surely die. The landlady then threatened to alert my university if I continued to refuse to comply with her wishes. And sure enough, I was soon summoned to the office of the president of the art school, a smiling bureaucrat who told me that he'd heard about a certain problem to do with housing. I should, of course, understand that the university should never be inconvenienced in this manner again. And so I moved to a one-room apartment in an old geisha district, next door to a couple of fervent believers in the Soka Gakkai Buddhist movement. They would leave a copy of their religious paper at my door every day until the pile of unread journals became too high and had to be removed. I used my tiny lavatory as an improvised darkroom to develop film. Next door was an old-fashioned public bathhouse where I would go for a wash every evening. My fellow bathers were very polite. They pretended that I wasn't there. To claim that what happened later had anything to do with my odious landlady in Meijido, or the pusillanimity of the Nichidai Art School president, would be disingenuous. There is simply no excuse for it. My behavior on New Year's Eve in Kyoto was simply disgraceful. Five of us traveled down to Kyoto, my friend Tsuda, my flatmate Rob, an American student of Japanese history named Jim, a fellow Nichidai student we called Kin-san, and myself. Junko, a young avant-garde dancer who had attached herself to Rob, joined us later. We all stayed in one room at a rather dilapidated inn on the Kamo River. The inn, like similar places in the neighborhood, had once been a brothel. After prostitution was officially banned in the late 1950s, many of these old houses were converted into cheap inns, catering mostly to young foreigners. Japanese tended to stay away from them, worried about their disreputable associations. The kind old lady who ran the inn, named Okinu, had herself once worked there as a prostitute. She had fond memories of American soldiers during the post-war occupation. The first day of the year is the most important festive day in Japan. Families gather to eat sumptuous cold delicacies all day, carefully prepared long before the event. Friends are invited to drink sake and eat sticky rice balls and miso broth from the early morning, usually after visiting temples and shrines the night before. Okinu, who might have been a prostitute but was a proud stickler for Kyoto tradition, promised that we would wake up to a spread of Kyoto New Year dishes in the morning. Tsuda had also arranged something special for New Year's Day. He had always been good at making an impression on old ladies who saw him as a promising intellectual whom they could help on his way to an illustrious literary career. One of these ladies was a very refined person from an old Kyoto family. She lived in a beautiful traditional house with a well-kept Japanese garden and a room for tea ceremonies. She had kindly invited Tsuda to bring his friends for a traditional New Year's lunch. We didn't give much thought of all these feasts to come, as we set out on the frosty New Year's Eve with the stars blazing brightly over the snow-covered temple roofs of Kyoto. The streets were filled with throngs of young Japanese, many of them dressed in kimonos for the occasion, slowly shuffling their way to the ancient religious places that had miraculously survived the war, since at the last minute, Kyoto had been struck off the list of cities to be obliterated by an atom bomb. The story goes that Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson had visited Kyoto before the war and couldn't bear the idea of destroying this historic city. We had already drunk quite a lot of beer, and were now passing around a huge bottle of sake, which we drank straight from the bottle. Dizzy from drink and the freezing cold, we began to get a little boisterous. There would be no chance that these gaijin were going to be politely ignored this time. I cannot remember whether it was Jim or myself who decided that it would be a splendid joke to reverse roles and subject Japanese strangers to all the clichés that we had had to hear in our daily lives. "Can you stomach raw fish?" we would ask, astonished passers-by. "What about chopsticks? How amazing that you can use them so skillfully. And could you tell us all about America?" And so it went on, as we got steadily more inebriated and obnoxious. In any other country, we would have received a fully justified thrashing. We can only thank Japanese politeness for the fact that we did not. Tsuda and Kinsun pretended to find all of this highly entertaining as well. One large bottle of sake followed another. After midnight, I literally could not stand on my feet any longer and had to be dragged back to our inn, where Kinsun fell straight through the glass window of our room, creating a cold draught that none of us noticed, since we swiftly fell into a deep sleep, except for Jim, or Rob, and the young dancer. One of them, or perhaps both, no one could quite recall, had had sex with a dancer on the matted floor in the midst of shards of glass. We woke up late the next morning to find the beautifully prepared dishes laid out by Okinu on the table with little bottles of sake for each of us. Just looking at food or drink was enough to make us feel sick. Rob and Kinsun rolled over moaning and fell into a kind of coma. When Okinu came in to wish us a happy new year and ask whether we had enjoyed the meal, I had to make excuses and explain that we had had a rough night. Her eyes took in the scene of utter pandemonium in the room, and she withdrew without saying a word. It was about 2 in the afternoon when we finally roused ourselves with pounding headaches and queasy stomachs to visit Tsuda's kind and elegant patroness. We had been expected at noon. The square black table was covered in the daintiest dishes, beautifully prepared herring roe and chrysanthemum-shaped lotus roots in black lacquer boxes, plump red salmon roe and giant grilled shrimp brined in sugar. Our hostess, dressed in a graceful kimono of discreet pink and grey flower patterns, explained, without a hint of annoyance, that it would have been so much better if we'd arrived on time, since the colours of the bowls and plates had been especially chosen to match the light shining through the rice paper windows. As it was later now, she'd been forced to replace the utensils with a different set to match the time of day. As she was explaining this, and we were trying to pick at some of the dishes for the sake of politeness, Tsuda had withdrawn to the lavatory, emitting awful gurgling noises, which we were all studiously pretending not to hear. Despite our delicate physical condition, we managed to sit through the lunch making polite conversation. Jim picked up one of the lovely tea bowls, turned it around, and asked if it was from the Edo period. "Yes," said the kind lady, "you are quite right. You foreigners are so knowledgeable. We Japanese are quite ignorant in comparison. But it isn't quite from the Edo period, but a little bit older than that. Azuchi Momoyama, actually, late 16th century." After Tsuda had finally emerged from his ablutions, it was almost time to leave. The sun was already sinking, casting a lovely glow onto the exquisite dishes we had left largely untouched on the table. We thanked our hostess profusely and apologized for having been late. "Never mind," said the lady. "You're all most welcome to come back at any time." I was the first to climb down from the wooden hallway into the stone entrance where our shoes were waiting for us in a perfect straight line. I bent over my shoes, about to put them on, facing the door with my back to my friends and the lady of the house who was bowing them out. And out it came, I could not help it, like a short blast from a trumpet. There was a second of stunned silence. I stood up. We all pretended that we hadn't heard or smelled a thing. Chapter 6. New Year's Eve, 1977, at the Asbestos Studio. This two-story building in Meguro Ward was named after the poisonous insulation material manufactured there before it became a dance studio. Various people on the ground floor were taking turns pounding sticky rice with a heavy wooden mallet to produce traditional rice cakes for the new year. I knew that many of them were famous, but I recognized only a few and had little idea of how distinguished they actually were. Ikeda Masuo, the print artist and novelist, thin like a dandelion with bushy curls sprouting from his narrow head, was sprawled on the floor fast asleep, despite the hubbub around him. Japan's greatest modern poet, Tanikawa Shuntaro, was in deep conversation with Shibusawa Tatsuhiko, the pale-skinned essayist and translator of the Marquis de Sade. Shibusawa wore dark glasses and spoke formal 18th-century French in a soft, halting voice. Hosoe Eiko, the photographer who once took pictures of Mishima posing naked as Saint Sebastian, pierced by arrows, pointed his camera at a group of male dancers with shaven heads like brown eggs, bobbing up and down in the melee. I noticed the architect Isozaki Arata and Ono Kazuo, a refined-looking gentleman in his 70s who was well known for his slow, stylized tango dance performances in white lace ball gowns, performances he would continue into his 90s, even though he could barely walk. Shiraishi Kazuko, the sexy poet and former lover of Muhammad Ali, was there. Yamashita Yosuke, the free jazz pianist in steel-rimmed glasses, was pouring sake for Maro Akaji, an actor and a dancer. I was tagging along with Maro. "Come and meet Hijikata-san," he said. I knew who Hijikata was, of course. Everyone interested in theater and dance in Japan did. He was the father of Ankoku Buto, or Dance of Darkness, the modern Japanese dance form more or less invented by Hijikata in the late 1950s as a deliberately grotesque aesthetic reaction against Western ballet and classical Japanese dance. Hijikata had just given up dancing himself, but as a choreographer, he was still king of the Buto world. The Asbestos Studio was his company. His father-in-law had owned the old asbestos factory. I had first seen Hijikata at a performance by Maro Akaji's troupe. There he is," people around me whispered as he passed by our seats with his chief dancer, Ashikawa Yoko. A tall man with a wispy beard, thick black eyebrows, and long salt-and-pepper hair tied loosely in a knot, he looked like a guru of some sort, pretending to ignore the commotion his entrance had caused. I protested that I would have nothing to say to the great man. "No," Maro insisted, "I should be properly introduced." We went up the narrow stairs to a big loft-like space where Hijikata was sitting at a long wooden table, talking to a number of people, most of whom I didn't recognize. Ashikawa sat next to him, a fine-boned woman with small myopic eyes and a prominent jaw. On stage, grimacing in white face, her eyes almost disappearing into their sockets, her blackened teeth bared, she looked like the decaying corpse of one of those stylized kabuki actors in an 18th century print. Hijikata told his star dancer to move up and patted the cushion next to him, telling me to sit down. Maro introduced me as a young film student who knew Donald Ritchie. Hijikata nodded politely. He had known Donald since 1959, when Hijikata gave his first Buto performance, inspired by Mishima's novel Forbidden Colors, about the seduction of a beautiful young man by a cynical old novelist. The show, in which a priapic Hijikata acted out the rape of the young man, danced by Ono Kazuo's son with a live chicken squeezed between his thighs, had caused an uproar in Tokyo. Donald had come to see it with Mishima. He was so impressed that he decided to make a film with the dancer. Donald's 10-minute film, called Sacrifice, shot with an 8mm camera, was long thought to have been lost, but was found and restored to its original, slightly underexposed condition. To the sound of Handel's Messiah, a young dancer is assaulted by a group of delirious men and women in flapping kimonos who shit and vomit all over him before castrating him with a meat cleaver. I had not seen the movie when I met Hijikata, nor do I recall whether I had even heard of it then. But I knew that Hijikata's work was suffused with pain, torture, and death. He talked a great deal about Jean Genet. His favorite artist was Hans Bellmer, the German surrealist in Paris who specialized in mutilated female dolls and fine drawings of erotic perversities. Hijikata based several of his dance pieces on works by Desaad. "So, young man," he said, kindly pouring a cup of sake for me, "what exactly do you do?" I explained that I was studying cinema. He grunted, "Studying, studying, we're all studying, but what are you intending to do with your studies?" I mumbled something about photography and film, but without much conviction. "What was your name again?" I told him my name. "Buruma," which in Japanese sounds more like bloomers, pronounced Buruma. "Ah," he said, "underpants. So, my dear Pants, what music do you like? Tell me something unusual, something I don't know." Too intimidated to answer, I asked him what his favorite music was. "Why change the subject?" he asked. "We were talking about you." I could sense that I was boring him. He then decided to put on a little show, not for my benefit, but more in a fit of drunken lassitude to change the mood. "Ashikawa," he barked at his chief dancer, "go out and buy some more sake." She looked perplexed. "But sensei," she muttered, "it's past midnight. The shops are closed." It was hard to tell whether Hijikata was really angry or whether it was just for display. "Didn't you hear what I said? Go out and bring me more sake." He waved his hand dismissively. "Go, go, go!" And off she went, also for show, hanging around in the freezing night until she felt that it was okay to come back and tell the master that she tried her best. In the meantime, Hijikata had given up on me and talked rather interestingly about Hans Bellmer. His dolls of women in all kinds of grotesque contortions made in the 1930s were a protest against the Nazi cult of healthy Aryan bodies. Bellmer's dolls bore a resemblance to Buto dancers in their tortured movements. Japanese bodies, Hijikata explained, were not like long-limbed gaijin bodies. "All our power is in the thighs, so we don't stretch when we dance. We squat. We like to get close to the earth." This remark came back to me much later, when I finally saw Donald's film Sacrifice, when a woman slowly sinks her body over the sacrificial victim and pisses on him before she helps to slice off his balls. Hijikata then switched the topic to Abesada, the prostitute who cut off her lover's penis after strangling him in an erotic game, the subject of In the Realm of the Senses. "I knew Sada," said Hijikata. "She was an artist. Artists must be like criminals. They must draw blood." While the sensei spoke, everyone around the table kept quiet, nodding at his aperçus. Silently, Ashikawa slipped back into the room. Hijikata didn't even ask her whether she'd managed to procure any sake. Perhaps he'd forgotten all about it. "Pants," he said, as I made to go back downstairs. "You know what you are. You're a television." I'm still not entirely sure what he meant, but I think I know. He had not meant it kindly, but he had a point. I was still soaking up the lives of others, studying instead of creating anything, reflecting back like a camera, rather than giving anything of myself. But I'd been offered the chance in a minor way to do so. In the year leading up to New Year's Eve at the Asbestos studio, I'd begun to dip one foot at least into the dance world myself. Sometime in the spring of 1977, Ritsai Tenkata turned up in Tokyo. I'd seen him before in Amsterdam, but never really got to know him. He was the founder of the Mikkari Theatre, where I'd first seen Terayama's Tenjo Sajiki. The son of a wealthy textile manufacturer, Ritsart was extraordinary to look at, especially in Tokyo. Very tall, clumsy in his movements, with a booming voice, he had a face like an unmade bed, hooded eyes, loose cheeks, lips like two cuts of liver, and long strands of blonde hair streaming from the back of a large bald head. In moments of boredom, he was given to putting on silly Dutch voices, which must have baffled the Japanese. Ritsart was also one of the most important international theatre impresarios of the 20th century. He nurtured the talents of Peter Sellars, Willem Dafoe, Robert Wilson, and many others, and the Japanese knew it, so he was treated with great deference. Ritsart had come to find out what was going on in the Japanese theatre, and I was to be his guide. We buzzed around town in a yellow Fiat, driven by a long-haired photographer named Herbie Yamaguchi, who was the boyfriend of Teriyama's ex-wife, a chain-smoking former show dancer to whom I gave weekly English lessons. Her stage name was Kujo Eiko. She managed the Tenjo Sajiki. Despite his shambling appearance, Ritsart was a deeply cultivated man with an instinctive feel for the theatre. "I don't judge art with my head," he liked to say. "I have to feel it in my balls." He had heard about Hijikata and his Buto dancers from Kujo and seen some film footage. His aim, fruitless as it turned out, was to coax Hijikata into performing in Amsterdam. The main Buto troupe in Tokyo, aside from the Asbestos studio, was Maro Akaji's Dairakudakan. Ritsart wanted to meet Maro too. Maro agreed to see us at the Dairakudakan studio in a crowded residential area in the southeast of Tokyo. He looked as remarkable as Ritsart. With a clean-shaven head, a black moustache drooping down the sides of his mouth, and observant hangdog eyes, there was something melancholy and also faintly sinister about him. In fact, he was warm and humorous. But I could see why Karajuro used to cast him as lugubrious ghosts and other grotesques, when Maro had been one of the main actors in Kara's Situation Theatre in the 1960s. I could also see why Maro appeared in many movies as a monster of one kind or another. Both Kara and Maro regarded Hijikata as their theatrical mentor. He had taught them to use the body as the central element in drama. Hijikata, and after him others in the avant-garde theatre, rebelled against the academic style of theatre in Japan. Too often in the recent past, Japanese actors and dancers appear to be mimicking Westerners. The way back to authenticity, as it were, was not to revive Japanese traditions such as no or kabuki, which had already become theatrical museum pieces, but to revive the spirit of Japanese drama expressed through a stylized, sometimes violent use of the body. Terayama encouraged his actors to confront the audience physically. Kara's actors used their bodies in the exaggerated manner of slapstick comedians. Maro left Kara's group in the early 1970s to form the Dairakudakan, the most theatrical of the Buto companies. Maro is not a trained dancer, but an actor who uses body language instead of words to perform his deliberately outlandish dance theatre pieces. Kara and Terayama stuck with words. Maro abandoned them. Ritsart and I sat on the wooden floor of Maro's studio, watching his dancers moving like embalmed corpses slowly coming to life, limbs twitching, faces grimacing, eyes rolling, mouths opened wide in silent screams. They crawled and slithered, they squatted and twisted their bodies like those Belma dolls. Since this was a rehearsal, they did not wear the full-body buto makeup of white rice flour. But the men were all as hairless as Buddhist monks. Some had even shaved off their eyebrows. The loud metallic sound of Tangerine Dream, the German rock group, was jangling on a tape recorder. I asked Ritzeit what he thought after we got back to his hotel. He shrugged his shoulders. He couldn't explain why he wasn't all that impressed. Hijikata was the real thing, he kept repeating. I couldn't understand his skepticism. I thought the dancers were extraordinary. It was only later, long after he'd returned to Amsterdam, that I grasped what Ritzeit knew instinctively. What we had seen at Maro's rehearsal studio was a very Japanese phenomenon. A theatrical method that had been created by a great artist through sheer daring and experimentation had become established as a style, passed on by masters of various schools, all with their own variations. This had happened to the tea ceremony, once a spontaneous expression of aesthetic joy in drinking tea, now a rigid set of rules to be learned by wealthy ladies who pay a fortune to the various tea ceremony schools. The same thing had happened to classical theatre and to flower arranging. And now, in a way, it was happening even to a once avant-garde dance form. This didn't mean that Maro's group was mediocre. He was an extraordinary performer and his dancers were superb. Nor was he simply imitating his master. What was lacking was the danger of Hijikata's early work, when anything could happen and people could still be outraged. This was not just a matter of personalities. Much of what was developed in the 1960s became formalized, even mannered, in later years. Tereyama Shuji died in 1983. His acolytes still perform his plays in the style that he laid down. His theatrical innovations gelled into a set of patterns, as inflexible in their ways as the ritualized moves in Kabuki or No. This is not a uniquely Japanese phenomenon, but it is perhaps more pronounced in Japan. I was drawn to Buto from the first time I saw it. Though highly sophisticated, it was yet another variation of the erotic, grotesque, absurd strain in Japanese culture, an avant-garde expression of nostalgie de la boue. My own interest in this doubtless sprang from a different source than Hijikata's, who was born in the muddy rice lands of northeastern Japan. I was in any case ready to prove that I was more than a television camera looking from the outside in. As it happened, this coincided with a common desire among Japanese artists to reach out to the world outside their native archipelago. Unlike Hijikata, Maro was keen to take his company abroad. The Dance of Darkness had already spawned a number of groups in Japan, led by amazing personalities bearing odd stage names. Bishop Yamada once appeared in Maro's studio with two young nude dancers on a leash crawling ahead of him like prize dogs. There was a lot of talk in the studio of spreading Buto all over the world like a movement that would grow and grow. The idea of half-naked Japanese dancers covered in white rice flour twisting their bodies in a simulation of life after death, sweeping the world, seemed preposterous to me. But I was wrong. Since the 1980s, Buto troupes have performed in many parts of Europe and the United States as well as Asia. The best-known group outside Japan is probably Amagatsu Ushio's Sankaijuku, which has performed in more than 60 countries. In 1985, one of the dancers, suspended by his ankles on a rope, dangling from the sixth floor of the Mutual Life Building in Seattle, fell to his death when the rope snapped. It was a frightful accident, of course, but the dancer never changed his rigid position as though sticking to his performance as he plunged. The fatal act was called Dance of Birth and Death. Amagatsu was one of Maro's main dancers when I began to visit the studio regularly. Born in 1949, he was 6 years younger than Maro. Hijikata was born in 1928, Mishima in 1925, Terayama in 1935, Karajudo in 1940. There were rumors that Hijikata had trained to be a kamikaze pilot, but was saved at the last minute from suicidal death by Japan's surrender. Terayama lost his father in the war and barely escaped from the bombing of his hometown. Kara was evacuated from Tokyo as a child and came back to find nothing but devastation. Maro's mother went insane after her husband was killed in the war. Amagatsu grew up in Yokosuka, a rough town that was once the main base of the Imperial Japanese Navy and was taken over in 1945 by the U.S. Navy. All these artists, in one way or another, were marked by the war and its aftermath. They grew up with horrific violence or its wreckage. Mishima, a frail and bookish young man, was declared unfit for military service and regretted it forever. All he could do was act out brutal and heroic fantasies in his novels, as a film actor and as a photographic model, and finally, for real, in the bloody coup de théâtre of his public samurai suicide. Death and rebirth are the main themes of The Dance of Darkness. Every piece directed for the Daidakudakan by Maro revolved around it. It was as though this form of dance theatre reflected the painful rebirth of Japan from the ashes of the catastrophe it had unleashed. Buto was not only a reaction to prissy Western and Japanese high culture, it was also the expression of several generations of Japanese who'd lived with violent death. Hence, the mummified bodies in white makeup twisted and contorted like corpses after a bombing raid, creeping back toward life. Despite the morbidity of their art, Maro and his troupe were enormous fun to be with. We would talk through the night about dance, culture, sex, and literature while consuming huge amounts of alcohol. The one thing we didn't do was drugs. In the chaos of the occupation years, many Japanese used a methamphetamine called hiropon, providing a tidy income for gangsters. Some rock and rollers took other kinds of speed pills, and young people could be seen slumped against the walls of underground shopping malls or railway stations sniffing glue from plastic bags. But even among underground theater folks, there was very little use of cannabis or cocaine. A famous female pop singer was caught once with some marijuana. She had to offer a public apology and was banned from the major television shows. Maro insisted that I train together with his dancers. It was no good just to be a watcher. I had to put my body into it if I wanted to understand what they were doing. And so I, too, wriggled and contorted and squatted, even though my dancing skills were minimal. But that didn't seem to bother Maro. "Skill isn't the point," he said. "I want to know what you're made of." He would make me stand still on the studio floor and study me through rings of cigarette smoke, a bit like a palm reader scrutinizing the lines of a person's hand. "Each body has a spirit," he would say, "an aura." I felt more comfortable dancing badly than having my aura examined in this manner. Maro took another puff of his cigarette and just laughed. Since the contemporary arts in Japan received no official subsidies, Buto dancers were sent out to cabarets and strip shows to generate extra income for their groups. Hijikata started this practice. Maro, as well as Kara and his Korean Japanese wife, Lee Leisen, used to perform something called the Kimpun Show. Their naked bodies, naked apart from a tiny piece of cloth covering the genitals like a skimpy jockstrap, were painted gold like the girl in the James Bond movie Goldfinger. They would dance in smoky little clubs on the outskirts of Tokyo to the music of Tom Jones or Barry Manilow on scratchy tapes, or sometimes in the better clubs to live bands. One day, Maro announced that it was my turn to do a show. I protested that I wasn't ready for it. Maro grinned and said that all I had to do was to stand still, strike a pose, and let the girl do the dancing around me. My partners would be a couple who went by the name of Dance Love Machine. They were excellent dancers, which made me nervous even about the prospect of standing still. We took the train to Kawasaki, an industrial slum inhabited by poor Koreans. The streets were shabby and smelled of fermented cabbage and open sewers. But the laws were looser than in Tokyo, hence the many strip clubs and sex shows. Our destination was called Yamashita Paradise, misspelled as Paradise, in flashing neon lights. A young man with frizzy permed hair and tattooed eyebrows A not uncommon look among low-ranking yakuza ushered us inside. Since this was not a kimpun show, there was no need to be covered in gold paint. For my number with Anzu, the female half of Dance Love Machine, all I needed to wear was a tiny scarlet jockstrap. Anzu, in a minuscule bikini bottom of sparkling silver, told me not to worry about a thing. She was a skilled modern ballet dancer as well as a buto performer. She would do all the work. All I needed to do was to catch her in my arms at the end of the dance. The stage felt clammy. There was a smell of stale beer and cigarettes. I could hear the men in the audience chatting loudly, but could not see them because of the colored spotlight shining in our faces. Tom Jones began to sing It's Not Unusual. I struck up a manly pose, a bit like Charles Atlas in the bodybuilding ads, and Anzu started her sinuous dance around me. Everything seemed to be going fine. I felt almost relaxed. I could get used to this kind of thing. Alas, relief can turn to complacency in seconds. My attention flagged just at the wrong moment. Anzu flung herself into my waiting arms. Tom Jones sang his last notes. It's not unusual to find out that I'm in love with you, wah, wah. I was taken by surprise and made the only mistake I could possibly have made. I dropped her onto the stage floor. There was no booing from the audience, just a stunned silence, which was worse. It was as if my embarrassment filled the dark void like a ghastly miasma. Nothing was said in the dressing room as we hastily put on our clothes for the trip back to Tokyo. Once again I apologized to Anzu in the train. She smiled thinly. I never performed in a cabaret again. Having spent more than 2 years at least nominally as a film school student, and spurred by Maro and others that I should do something, make something of my own, I decided it was time to try my hand at making a short movie. The resulting script of First Love, or Hatsukoi in Japanese, showed all the marks of a young man who'd seen too many Roman porno films. Even the irony of the title itself was heavy as a sledgehammer. My friend Tsuda played the leading character, a solitary figure in the big city craving a woman's love. One day, walking the streets, he is approached by a young woman who promises to show him a good time. They go to his tiny apartment, shot on location in my living bedroom in Meijiro. He believes that he has found a girlfriend at last. She asks him for money when the good time is over. In a blind rage, he kills her. Kin-san, my friend from the Nichidai Film School, shot the movie on 16mm film. An apprentice dancer from the Asbestos studio called Miho, whom I was madly in love with, played the girl. Small and lithe, Miho was studying French literature and performing most nights at a large burlesque theater near the Ginza, where Ri Koran, the Manchurian movie star, gave concerts during the war, before turning into Shirley Yamaguchi after Japan's surrender. I cannot blame Tsuda, Miho, or Kin-san for the failure of this morbid study of alienation. The story was full of unearned darkness. I cannot even claim that it was a true expression of my own deepest feelings. The film might have been more interesting if that had been true. It was just a pale reflection of the erogudo nonsensu that I'd been lapping up in Tokyo. Others had expressed the same sort of thing with more wit. Hatsukoi should never have been shown to anyone. And yet it was. Perhaps Gaijin's privilege kicked in once more. Kawakita Kazuko, the daughter of Kawakita Nagamasa, the film producer in wartime Shanghai, ran a film distribution company called Franzu Egasha. She had handled films by Visconti, Fellini, Wim Wenders, and Godard. Outside Japan, she had introduced audiences to Oshima's work. Kazuko was one of the most attractive and important figures in the movie business. She was also unfailingly generous. And so she offered to screen my movie at her company in the same room where films by Oshima, Chris Marker, and Godard were shown. Kazuko, Donald Ritchie, and I settled into our seats for the screening. When the lights went up after 15 minutes, there was a short silence. "Well," Kazuko said brightly, "I think it's time to go for dinner." Not so long after that, Maro decided that I should be in the next Daidakudakan show. But perhaps with my cabaret performance in mind, you would mercifully spare me the embarrassment of acting as a dancer. We would embark on a short tour through Japan, first to Nagoya, then to Kyoto. My simple role, Maro reassured me, was to stick my head through a window on stage and imitate Adolf Hitler. The title of the piece was Arashi, meaning tempest. The show lasted about as long as Ravel's Bolero, which was played at high volume throughout, as Maro's star dancers, including Amagatsu, Anzu, Morobushi Ko, and Carlotta Ikeda, squirmed and cowered and silently screamed in the requisite Buto manner, their bodies coated with rice flour and streaks of blood-red paint. There was little point in rehearsing an improvisation of the Führer's tirade, and so I too did the same physical exercises as the dancers. This made me feel fitter without necessarily improving my proficiency. Ravel's Bolero is not an easy piece to sit through once without getting restless. Hearing it over and over can become a torment. But the spectacle of cadaverous bodies straining to come to life in different variations, and Maro solo dance as a swaying mummy with black eyes in a chalky face like some creature of the night, was, to say the least, arresting. We travelled to Nagoya in a large van. Everyone was in good cheer. Amagatsu cracked jokes. Maro's mournful features creased with laughter as memories of former tours were recalled. It was one of those brisk, sunny Japanese fall days, when everything looked sharply etched like a woodblock print. Even Mount Fuji, which is usually hidden in clouds, stood out like an ice cream cone against the almost cobalt blue sky. One of the male dancers rather ostentatiously turned his back to the window, exclaiming to no one in particular that there was nothing pretty about Mount Fuji. Fuji, as much of an icon in Japan as the Eiffel Tower is of Paris, has a peculiar status, with right-wing connotations. In the world of Shinto, many rocks, rivers, and other forces of nature are considered to be divine, but Mount Fuji is the most sacred of all. When Shinto, which began as a form of nature worship, with rituals to ensure fertility and good harvests and so on, became a state cult in the late 19th century, it came to be associated with militarism, ultra-nationalism, and worship of the emperor, until this type of thing was banned under the American occupation after the war. I don't think the dancer who turned his back on the Holy Mountain did so as a form of political protest against the icon's chauvinistic history. Fuji is now a harmless symbol anyway, a popular decoration on the tiled walls of public bathhouses in the days before such bathhouses began to disappear, as more and more people were able to take baths at home. More likely, his gesture was a proper Buto-like disdain for conventional beauty. Authenticity lay in deliberate ugliness. It is true that Hijikata was inspired by his childhood in the rural northeast, but the dance pieces he created didn't celebrate the splendors of nature. They were more redolent of backbreaking work in the rice fields and bodies shrinking from the icy winds of endless winters. Nagoya is the neatest city in Japan, perhaps the most boring. Like almost every other place, it was pretty much destroyed in the last years of the war. But unlike Tokyo or Osaka, whose rebirths were as capricious as human life, Nagoya was the only city to be rebuilt according to a carefully worked-out plan. It is a city of straight and wide avenues, as rational as a mathematical equation. Nagoya's main distinction is the invention of the pachinko pinball machine, which was ubiquitous all over Japan. There were many more pachinko parlors than cinemas, let alone bookstores. In the 1970s, you could hear them from a long way off, the noise of cascading silver balls combining with the deafening background military music, the Imperial Navy's warship march being especially popular. But not everything in Nagoya was soulless and new. We were to perform at a tumble-down old theatre, mostly used by travelling groups like the one I'd photographed near the old execution grounds in Tokyo. It has probably been pulled down by now. The wooden building had a musty odour of tatami mats that hadn't been replaced often enough. The stage was on the ground floor, We all slept on the ratty tatamis in a large room above the theatre. At night, that is also where we ate, sang songs, and drank too much. Since the local press or radio stations wouldn't take any notice of a Bhutto troupe arriving in town, we had to do our own publicity, which meant driving our van through the main streets, advertising our performance through a megaphone. I'd often been annoyed, as were most Japanese, even if they rarely showed it, by the ubiquitous sound trucks in Tokyo of uniformed right-wing fringe groups, mostly small-time gangsters, bellowing militaristic slogans and playing wartime martial songs. But I enjoyed addressing crowds in this manner. It felt good to hear my own amplified voice booming at the modern buildings. We parked the van near the front entrance of Nagoya's main railway station, where Amagatsu, Carlotta, and the others startled commuters by doing a half-naked Bhutto dance, while I used the megaphone to invite people to come see us perform at 7:30. By 7:15, the theatre was so full that it felt dangerous to me. This was not an unusual situation. I'd been to performances inside small wooden buildings, packed with people, with kerosene stoves to keep us warm and no fire escapes. For a highly organized society with rules for everything and an almost universal fear of the unexpected, there was a curious recklessness about the way some things were done. It was as though without clear rules, people felt no need to use common sense. I was surprised at first to see how nobody would jaywalk, even without a single car in sight, but would think nothing of walking straight through heavy traffic in the absence of a red light. Our performance in Nagoya was a success. Death and rebirth were painfully reenacted to the sounds of Bolero. Even though only my face was seen, peering through a window around about the time when the trumpets come on, I was still fully made up in white and wore nothing but a jockstrap. Pulling Hitler-like grimaces, I did my rant in cod German, as Maro swayed back and forth in a tattered red kimono, and the entire group danced for the finale, with lots of dried brown fish attached to red cords, like arteries or intestines dropping to the stage. The party afterwards was held upstairs in our sleeping quarters, where long tables were laid out, covered with plates of delicious raw fish provided by a local Bhutto fan who happened to be a fishmonger. All that remains in my memory is a blur of florid faces singing and drinking and laughing. One of the dancers climbed on the table and did a slow grind, while three of the women dancers improvised a kind of French can-can to the sound of our rhythmic clapping. A friendly jazz drummer tapped along furiously with chopsticks on his beer glass. Nobody got hurt. We rolled out our bedding at around 3 in the morning. The venue in Kyoto, called the Seibu Kodo, was even more remarkable than the old theatre in Nagoya. It was a huge barn of a place with a traditional Japanese-style roof, on which there were still traces of the three painted stars of Orion's belt. Frank Zappa had performed in this hall the year before and declared that it was the craziest place he'd ever played in. That must have been an exaggeration, but the Seibu Kodo's history was indeed curious. Built for Kyoto Imperial University in 1937, the year that Japan invaded China, to commemorate the birth of Emperor Hirohito, it was taken over in the early 1970s by student radicals and had since become a venue for rock and roll and theater groups. After the rehearsal, just as the sun went down, casting a burnt orange glow on the yellow-starred roof, naked dancers in rice flour and ash stood around the palms and cypress trees like figures in a fairy tale. I could only gaze in wonder at the beauty of the scene, made more surreal by the faint sound of Bolero drifting from the hall, when my girlfriend in the black leather trousers, the one who liked Roxy music, said she was going back to our dormitory. She'd come down from Tokyo especially to see us perform. Her name was Chieko. She wasn't feeling well. The dorm was in a rather dilapidated pre-war university building. When I caught up with Chieko a few hours later, she was clearly upset by something. She wouldn't tell me what it was. Only weeks later, when we met up again in Tokyo, she blurted out that in my absence, one of the dancers had tried to push her onto the tatami. When she protested, he said, "You do it with a gaijin, so why not with one of us?" The show went even better than in Nagoya. The dorm had been cleared for the party. Amagatsa was being his amiable self, moving around the room, pouring drinks and telling jokes. Maro was beaming as though on a high. We sat in a large circle, passing around beer and whiskey and flasks of sake. A fish stew was boiling away in a brazier. Chieko appeared to have recovered. We sang old high school songs, of which I never learned all the words, like students around a campfire. There was dancing. Urged, as is customary on such occasions, to contribute to the entertainment, I sang the theme song from a well-known Yakuza movie called Theater of Life. Throw away our chivalrous duty and the world will go dark. Things began to wind down around 1 in the morning. One or two people were already curled up in their futons. Maro was smoking and chatting with one of the female dancers, Anzu perhaps. I saw Amagatsu staring from the other side of the room at a young male dancer sitting close to where I was. Amagatsu looked pale and wasn't smiling. All of a sudden, he grabbed one of the large empty sake bottles and flung it with full force at the man. The bottle crashed into his forehead with a nasty clunk, like hitting a coconut with a hammer. Blood began to gush from his wound, splashing my shirt. I don't mind violence in the movies, but never failed to be shaken by the real thing. I wanted to leave. Whatever personal motives Amagatsu might have had, or whatever group dynamics I had missed, I didn't want to know. I stood up and stomped out into the dark night with Chieko loyally in tow. My blood-soaked shirt felt cold and clammy in the autumn chill. The stars were shining brightly as we walked through the old streets of Kyoto, wooden houses on both sides, in search of a place to stay. As my shock wore off, I rather relished the romance of the situation. I don't know what the keeper of the shabby little inn, whom we roused from her bed by knocking loudly on the sliding bamboo door, must have thought, when she saw the foreigner in his bloody shirt with a young Japanese woman. But by some miracle she let us stay the night. Chieko went back to Tokyo the next morning. I returned to the dorm feeling a little sheepish about my self-righteous exit. Maro, who'd clearly witnessed such scenes many times before, was keen to soothe ruffled feathers. He said, "I'm sorry," to me in English. There seemed to be no more ill feeling between Amagatsu and the young dancer, whose head was swaddled in bandages like a turban. I explained how I felt about physical violence, how much I disliked it, and so on. Maro nodded and said that violence was not good. But my physical squeamishness must have seemed at odds with the intense physicality of Buto. One of the dancers made this clear when he turned to me and said, in a mixture of surprise and some disdain, "So, Buruma, you still believe in words." Chapter 7. Like many great cities, Tokyo is rarely a collection of villages. Each district, every neighborhood, has its own atmosphere. The Ginza, with its plush department stores and expensive boutiques. Ikebukuro, a little louche with petty gangsters and transvestite prostitutes lurking in the back streets behind the railway station. Harajuku, modish and full of teenagers. Kanda, literary, with the smells of old-fashioned Chinese restaurants and used books. By the 1970s, the artistic and cultural center of gravity had moved almost entirely to the west, away from the old popular areas in the eastern low city, the Shitamachi, along the Sumida River. Parts of the low city still had some seedy charm, but the old striptease joints and burlesque houses near the temple to the Goddess of Mercy in Asakusa had become sordid relics, attracting a sparse audience of old men and bums looking for a place to nap. The Asakusa Opera, a beacon of modernism before the war, was long gone. Once famous movie houses like the Meigaza had become shabby venues for porno films and endlessly rerun gangster pictures. There was still a tiny Korean area in Asakusa, where you could buy fermented vegetables pickled with red peppers, kept in plump brown earthenware pots. Korean immigrants had been lynched there in 1923 by Japanese mobs in a murderous rage after the terrible earthquake of that year. Koreans, idiotically, were accused of poisoning the water supplies. The Arizona, a Western-style restaurant where the great literary flaneur Nagai Kafu would have his pork cutlet for lunch every day until he died in 1959, was still in business. And so was the line of stalls, selling Buddhist trinkets, cheap kimonos, and sweet dumplings that led to the temple. But the erstwhile glamour of the shitamachi, celebrated by Kafu, only lived on as myth. The action had long since shifted to Shinjuku, especially the dense areas around the east exit of the main railway station. Shinjuku had a mythology of its own as the capital of the counterculture in the 1960s. Hipsters like the young Mado Akaji hung out at the Fugetsudo coffee bar, gone by the time I arrived in Japan. Student protesters fought the riot police in the wide avenues running between the station and the former red light areas of Kabukicho. Karajuro and his Situation Theatre set up their red tent in front of Hanazono Shrine, next to a warren of alleys called the Golden Guy that had once been filled with brothels and had since turned into tiny bars plastered with movie and theatre posters. With no room for more than 10 people at the most, these places were frequented by artists, writers, journalists, filmmakers, and an assortment of nocturnal hangers-on, arguing about art and revolution, and scrapping in drunken feuds that only the true connoisseur could possibly understand. Oshima Nagisa celebrated all this in a vivid but dated movie entitled Diary of a Shinjuku Thief, 1969, a sly homage to Jean Genet, featuring, among other Shinjuku legends, Karajuro and his actors, standing on their heads in front of Shinjuku Station, dressed in loincloths, displaying fake gangster tattoos, and describing themselves to the camera as theatrical vagabonds. The embers of that age still glowed a little in the 1970s. Memories were fresh. There were enough people around who'd been there when the students ran amok, or when Kara's actors staged a violent attack in the summer of 1969 on Terayama's Tenjo Sajiki headquarters, after Terayama, by way of a black joke, had sent Kara a funeral wreath on the opening night of his new play. During my time in Japan, there were still occasional brawls, but there was no more talk of revolution. Now, as I'm writing this in 2016, the Golden Guy bars have been abandoned by their old clientele, and become a destination, well advertised in Lonely Planet guides, for young Western tourists. I continued to meet Terayama from time to time at the first Tenjo Sajiki studio in the middle of Shibuya, the one that was assaulted by Kara's people in 1969. This was perhaps the flashiest entertainment district of Tokyo, a cacophonous hub of department stores, bars, restaurants, short-time hotels and movie theaters, a kind of neon-lit souk of commercial pleasure, like Shinjuku, but without any of its revolutionary aura. Shibuya was never a center of counterculture, but to a small-town boy like Terayama, longing for metropolitan escape, it must have looked like an urban nirvana. That first Tenjo Sajiki office and studio still bore the marks of 1960s hippy-dippy fashion. The facade of the building had a huge clown's face stuck onto it, as well as plastic limbs, various painted mannequins, and signs of the zodiac. Inside were a coffee bar, a small theatre, and a tiny office where Terayama would receive people. He was always courteous, even friendly, but in a watchful way. Like Andy Warhol, he liked to gather misfits and exhibitionists around him and use them as props for a world of his own creation. He had the erotic imagination of an obsessive voyeur, but as a man he exuded coolness, professional efficiency, and distance. He was a loner in his theatrical lair. Our conversations were usually brief. He would sit back in his leather chair and make gnomic statements like, "The Japanese are all masochists at heart." In the late 1970s, when Shibuya began to shed its rougher edges and became the mecca of teenage culture, Terayama moved his company to Azabu, a quieter, more expensive area. Gone were the zodiac signs and the plastic dolls. The new office studio was slick with chrome furniture and chic black walls. It suited him. Like so much else that began in the 1960s, the Tenjo Sajiki had grown up and become more polished, more urbane. Terayama always retained his distinct northeastern accent, but it was as though years of living his metropolitan dream had gradually washed away the earthiness of his origins. The old Tenjo Sajiki studio in Shibuya is now a fancy office building of steel and glass. Karajudo and his entourage could not have been more different. I can't recall exactly when I first met Kara. In any case, I'd seen several of his plays performed in various parts of Tokyo in that crimson tent. I was still involved with Maro Akaji's Dairakudaka.